We come to the fifth presentation, and we're understanding a pivot that is important. When we live in the world, our experience flows like a story. It has a beginning, it has a middle, it has an end. And when we string these episodes, these stories together, we get our chronology, we get our linear sense of what we have done and who we are and what we want to do. And so the past and the future are cut by a present moment. It's called the defining moment. And that defining moment is archetypally characterized by our sense of identity, by our idea of who I am, what I have done, and what I am going to do. And the I is for identity, is for identifying, is for the individual. It's for I. Those four dimensions of space-time within which experience flows become radically different when visionary consciousness comes into play. When visionary consciousness comes into play, it's like a fifth dimension. It occurs to make pliable what before was a flow of experience now tends to have a different character. The character who we were convinced we were now has other possibilities that we hadn't considered before. When they mature enough, that fifth dimension of consciousness will do what every process, and a field is like a matrix of processes, every process will engender a form that is appropriate to that process. Our character in that mythic horizon of experience emerges out of the forms of existence. The things that are, the actions that we do, come out of the field of nature. Existence comes out of nature, and our flow of experience makes us have a form called the mind. All those images of experience get stored in the imagination. All of the feeling tones of our experience come together in a sense that we can identify with our body. We can identify with our actions, with the rituals that we do. And the characterization of this cycle is thought, word, and deed. But the characterization of thought, word, and deed is in the reverse order of the way in which they are generated. Because the deed comes first, then comes the languaging of the experience based on that deed, then comes the thought that's the integral of all of those, it's the summation of all of those, and assumes the structures of symbolic thought in the mind, assume that nature is part of that, is all tied up in that. But when consciousness comes into play as a quintessential dimension, all of a sudden nature now becomes magical. What comes into existential phenomenality are forms that were not there before. They're variants that we have never seen before. There are uniquenesses that occur. All of a sudden, existence has much more to it than it did, but the field of consciousness engenders a form that we recognize as the person, quite radically, distinctly different from the individuality of who I think I am, of who I know that I think I am and identify with the body. All of a sudden, there's more to me than just the body. And so this third level of form is traditionally called spirit. So that we have a form of body, a form of mind, and a form of spirit. But the spirit form is not integral, but is a differential form. And instead of tying things together, it acts like a prism, like a crystal, like a jewel. And it radiates out a whole spectrum of possibilities. It is that spirit, person, form, who now, through the field of vision, is able to reach back through the mind, back through the symbolic forms, and nurture the character of the person in our experience in such a way that our experience now has a double quality to it. It can be based on the ritual comportment to existence and to selected actions, but it also now can relate in a future forward sense to possibilities that weren't there before and can be engendered because nature magically is able to accede to interesting requests. I would like to be different from who I was. I would like to change. I would like to transform. And so the name now for experience is no longer the mythic horizon, but the Greek word for that changed experience is psyche. And the psyche, psuche in Greek, is the butterfly. It means I can wrap myself in a cocoon of transformation and I can come out with wings. Beautiful wings. I can be different from who I was. And not only just once, but now that I know how to do this, I can become many different persons. I can have many different facets. And one of the classic books of understanding this in the 20th century was by Ouspensky, a Russian genius who studied under Gurdjieff, and one of his great books is In Search of the Miraculous. And he has a diagram that the prismatic person has as many eyes as they wish to develop. And so instead of having just one eye, it's like a fly's eye, it has all kinds of facets, and they can see individually, but gestaltly, collectively, in such a way that one now has an experience that is not simply linear, but is kaleidoscopic. Now you have learned how to transform transformation. You have become not only wise about life, you've become wise about being wise. And so the species had to expand itself from Homo sapiens to Homo sapiens sapiens. We're wise about being wise. We know how to transform transformation itself. Now we have an asymptotic quality to ourselves. And in that asymptotic quality expansion, we suddenly feel kin to the cosmos. not just this world, but any world. The phrase is of all possible worlds. Not just this sun, but any sun, any star, or any collection of stars. And this wisdom goes back more than 5,000 years, because the original goddess who embraced you at the end of this life cycle, ready for the kaleidoscopic rebirth, her name in Egypt was Nut, and her body was spangled with stars, so that when you would open the coffin, the inside of the coffin was painted with Nut, with her beautiful feet, and then her hands spanning an entire arc of the sky, and this was like the Milky Way in its feminine invitation, that you were able to not only come back in a rebirth, but to be resurrected into an eternity that can rebirth as many times as you would like, in as many different ways as you would like to explore. Now one has a very interesting kind of a situation. The timeline of the cycle of nature has been radically transformed, so that the present is no longer the arbiter of what is past and what is future, because the present moment has been transformed into a quality of presence. And when presence, jewel-like, comes into play, instead of it being a dividing line between past and future, it becomes a pivot in its full complementarity, and we call this chirality. It's a magnetic left-handed spiraling or a right-handed spiraling, and when they spiral together, all of a sudden you begin to get the double helix that characterizes DNA. And what's interesting is that the chirality is not parallel, but it's in a complementarity. One of the spirals is in fact like the sense of the natural integral, and it goes right-handed in a clockwise fashion, but the other one goes anti-clockwise in a left-handed chirality, and the two together now function very much like a double helix, but a double helix that is of endless expanse. Its spectrum of life exceeds the ability of a world to hold it. At the end of his gospel, St. John wrote, and many other things did Jesus do, and I suppose if they were all written down in books, the world itself would not be big enough to hold them all. That the presence is not an arbiter between a past and a future, but makes them parenthetically symmetrical. So that now, as one moves into the future, one also moves into a new past. The mathematical term for this is recursive. It has an effect that what is new now also was present invisibly before, and now you're aware of it, and so the past is rather different from what you had settled it to be. And so the future and the new past, as both grow, both influence each other, and if you direct yourself in either chirality, it will affect the other one, whether You thought so or not? One of the alchemical principles of transformation is that in order to transform one form into another, the previous form has to be completed. Then it can go into the transform. It has to be what it is completely, and when it's filled up completely, now something else can happen. The time-honored existential test of this for the psyche is to put the body into an extreme situation and let the psyche fill up to its completeness, and when it does, a very curious, unique, repeatable moment occurs where the present dissolves into presence. The three classic ways in our kind for 100,000 years, 200,000 years, who knows? You can fill up with terror. You can fill up with ecstasy. Or you can fill up with an equilibrium which becomes transcendent. The ecstasy was personified mythologically as Aphrodite, as Venus. The terror, Aries or Mars. And the equanimity, Athena. This quality of Minerva to be not only even, but to be completely even. The way Homer describes it is that the gray, sea-gray eyes of Athena looking to the horizon where the blue sky and the gray sea merge and become one, and that horizon is a perfect equanimity. In that balance, wisdom now does what ecstasy or terrificness does. When it fills completely, you can experience the quality of the presence. Our word that we use now is grace. It's not a moment of grace, it's the presence of grace. I was in a dangerous situation one time, and it was a multiple challenge of terrificness, and the fright in me shot right up, but the discipline, the yoga, of being able to work with it. And it came to a moment where the fright literally came and my hairs stood on end. And that's as far as it went. Because the Saharastra chakra is above the hairs of the head. And it is unruffled by fear. It is able to be compassionate about ecstaticness to the nth degree, and it is able to take the evenness of yoga and gift it to the presence of the divine. The Gita says, yoga is the evenness of mind, but a Maharaja yoga is the further reaches of possibility. The Raja yoga classically is being presented here as a Maharaja yoga. Or if you like, it's the yoga of civilization. This quality of inviting presence to come into play means that our quality of understanding either the past in a new way or the future in infinite possibilities is viable. The binary for an integral is always 0 and 1. That's how computers work. But the binary for a supersymmetry consciousness is infinity and 1. Or if you get really hyper space, the pairing is infinity and 0. We're looking at the way in which an ecology of consciousness can transform a cycle of nature and prepare us for a third kind of living. And that third kind of living takes place in a hyperspace, a 10-dimensional hyperspace, by which future and past as dimensions are available as space-time is. This is how interstellar travel and intergalactic travel and interdimensional travel is not only possible, it has varieties without end. We're looking at the way in which our particular generations, those that went just before us and those that are coming after us about two generations in, so that those who were born roughly in the 1890s all the way through to those born now in the 21st century belong to a threshold that is layered by several generations, which is a storm front of time forms. And that storm front of time forms has been passing through the space-time of this world, the space-time of this star system. Each star system has its own time forms, but shares eternity. And so there is not only a common denominator, but there's a common openness as well. One of the earliest qualities of our storm front of a new time form was the publication in 1895 of H.G. Wells' The Time Machine. What could be more conspicuous? And a few months later, after that was published, the electron was discovered, early 1896, the first subatomic particle. So that you have right away the cascade beginning of the fact that when one is visionarily conscious to the fullness that a artistic spirit person can emerge and now make works of art that prism the jewel-like possibilities of a new openness. H.G. Wells, just to take the one example, he published in 1895 The Time Machine, in 1896 The Island of Dr. Moreau, a man who experiments of speeding up evolution of animals so that they can become human. But they become human in terms of the animals that they were, and the island is populated with all of the failures of the trials leading up to it, and, well, you can see where it goes from there. In 1897, he got very fancy, and he published The Invisible Man. Are you getting the metaphors? In 1898, he published The War of the Worlds. Every single year, and this kind of metronome went on for almost a decade, every single year, somebody like H.G. Wells was finally realizing he didn't have to have gone to college. He was self-educated by having not only read in libraries. In our time in Los Angeles, Ray Bradbury never went to college, but he read in the Hollywood and downtown public library almost every day and ended up being one of the world's great visionaries. So too H.G. Wells. But the 1895 to about 2000-2001 period is a time storm threshold. The difficulty is that time forms have been a forefront problem of civilizations since the beginning, but became exacerbated about 2,500 years ago. Because 2,500 years ago, all of a sudden you had a precursor of what was the precursor to our time storm. And that time period is about 500 years. And if you go back 500 years from actually the defining year of the time form was 1991. And if you go back 500 years, you go back to 1491. And actually in 1492, the New World, Columbus, discovered. The very same year that the great translator of Plato, the first great translator in history of Plato into a contemporary language that could be read by many people, he finished his translations by doing the translation of Plotinus in 1492. If one goes back, not to 0 BC or 0 AD, but to 9 BC, one comes to the true threshold. And that threshold is the completion of the Roman Empire power. And the Roman Empire power in 9 BC was enshrined in a building called the Ara Pacis Augusti, the Temple of the Peace of Augustus Caesar. It was built on a bank of the Tiber River, where the great road from the north, the Via Flaminia, came into Rome, just like the Appian Way, the Via Appia, came from the south. The Via Flaminia, much more important, became because it came from not only the north of Italy, but over the Alps. It came in from like Gaul and Switzerland, Austria, etc. And so it was like a power point. And right across from it, across the Via Flaminia, Augustus built his own mausoleum, and they are both there today. The Ara Pacis Augusti was rediscovered in the 20th century and put back together again. And if one draws a line across the Tiber to the Vatican, the huge building that is on that line and splits it about in half is the Castle Sant'Angelo, the redoubt, round, huge, round tower fortress of the popes, which was the huge, round tower for the Roman emperors that in case of any kind of possible siege of Rome, they had a place to be that was unassailable. So the line of Roman power is made there. The Ara Pacis Augusti was finished in 9 BC. That's the time, the year, that Jesus was born in 9 BC. So you have a confluence always with time forms that can be not just identified, but can be understood by a cross intersection of many kinds of dimensions, so that if it is so, it will have resonances of past and future from that particular confluence of events, so that one can begin to compute back and forward in such a way that one recalibrates time so that it becomes real. It's no longer just mythic. It's no longer just belief. It's not limited to cycles, no matter how forceful they have been inculcated and maintained. The truth of history comes out and occurs and can be cross-checked, because the future and the new past will always have a symmetricality of resonance, and that the tone running through it will be the harmonic of the presence. And that harmonic of the presence will make the future and the new past a spectrum that is in perfect balance, so that one can understand prophetically what is to come and accurately what really did happen. Now man has a new quality that he belongs literally in a life among the stars. He's no longer limited to this world or to this star system, or even in nearby interstellar space of a couple thousand years, or galactic space of several tens of millions of years. He is at home wherever he will presence. One need not fear aliens from anywhere at any time, because we can outdistance by many dimensions any kind of hype and illuminate it. This quality has a very interesting, let's call it side effect. Someone who is powerful in presencing with someone else who is able to be presenced are in an eternal harmonic. They're always then, and always have been together, tuned. The most conspicuous person 2,000 years ago who achieved that kind of paired, shared presence tuning was Mary Magdalene. And she achieved shared presence with Jesus. So that tuning had a lot of side effects that were quite interesting, because anyone that was associated with Jesus or Mary Magdalene now were mutually shareable. And Mary Magdalene, too, is well known. It's called the Cave of the Seven Sleepers. It's the only venerated place in the world, other than Jerusalem and the tombs of Abraham and the patriarchs. The Cave of the Seven Sleepers is mentioned in the Quran as well as the Bible. Her sarcophagus is in the Cave of the Seven Sleepers, and it's enormous. Next week, and in the notes, I will make a blow up so that you can see it is massive. The sarcophagus more than a dozen feet, and its capstone is remarkably almost like Le Corbusier's roof of the chapel at Ronchamp. And the decoration is of energy swirls, large energy swirls in their chirality. The huge sarcophagus had two bodies in it. The first body in it was Mary, the mother of Jesus, When Mary Magdalene moved to Ephesus, Mary, the mother, was 63 years old, and Magdalene herself was 44. When Magdalene died in 57 AD, she was also interred in this sarcophagus, so that the mother and Magdalene were entombed together in a shared presence quality, so that later on the mythic and doctrinal reduction of marginalizing Mary Magdalene superinflated Mary the mother, so that you got the Virgin Mary, and Mary Magdalene became a disposable ex-prostitute, if you can imagine. What we're doing here, among 8 million other things, is to put that balance back so that one can understand that there is something here which recommends itself to being recalibrated. And it's not just the two Marys, but there's a third Mary. And the third Mary, these are the three Marys from a fresco that had been buried in the sand in what is today Iraq, on the Euphrates River, way up the river. The fortress was called Dura Europos. It was sacked by siege in 256 AD, and luckily this wall of the Christian cathedral was against one of the city walls, and when the turrets and everything crumbled, it buried and crushed the rest of the church, but the fresco survived. And so the three Marys are the best portraits we have of Mary Magdalene, of the mother, and of Mary, one of four sisters of Jesus. It is Mary Magdalene who is the virgin. Mary the mother had 9 children. All the daughters married, so there were 4 sons-in-law, and there were grandchildren. St. John and St. James were grandchildren of Mary the mother. St. Mark was a grandchild. Mary the sister was married to a man named Cleophas, and their son was St. Mark, who was about 9 years old at the time of the crucifixion and the resurrection. He was the young boy who served the wine at the Last Supper on the second floor, because that was their house. It was a very large house. They were very wealthy people. When we come back from the break, we'll take a look at something which is truly remarkable. That if you can look with kaleidoscopic historical vision through the jewel prism of your spirit person, taking the field of visionary differential consciousness, you can come to understand what, who, is, are. And here is a portrait of Mary Magdalene from Central Asia, 1,000 years after she, quote, died. The Greek word is komesis. She only went to sleep. Let's take a little break and we'll come back.